From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Barney Hoskins returns to From the Bookshelf this week. It's been a couple of years since he was with us, talking about his great biography of Tom Waits, Low Side of the Road. Barney Hoskins has also chronicled the music of Los Angeles in Waiting for the Sun and Hotel California, as well as books about the band, soul music, Haight Ashbury, Montgomery Clift, James Dean, and lots of others. He is also the managing editor of the website Rock's Back Pages. His latest book is Led Zeppelin, The Oral History of the World's Greatest Rock Band. Barney Hoskins, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Nice to be speaking with you again, Gary.
Okay, let's start by arguing about the title of your book, Led Zeppelin, The Oral History of the World's Greatest Rock Band. The world's greatest rock band? What about, say, the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or Vanilla Fudge?
Vanilla Fudge, yes. Well, now you really do have a point. It wasn't my preferred subtitle, I have to tell you. The book here in the UK is called Trampled Underfoot, and the subtitle is The Power and Excess of Led Zeppelin. The American publishers seemed to think that was a downer title, as they called it. I guess they wanted something a little more literal, a little more kind of obvious as to what the book comprised. As for the claim, the world's greatest rock band, I didn't even want that in there, I'll be honest with you. I was going to go for biggest or mightiest, it didn't really make me very happy, I'll have to be honest with you. But there we go. They know what they're doing, I guess, and their argument probably would be that they'll sell more books with the title as it is. Do I think they were the world's greatest rock band? I think certainly the world's greatest hard rock band. What they did with rock was very different from what, say, the Rolling Stones and certainly the Beatles did with rock. So it really is like comparing apples with oranges, I think. And it is too big a statement. They were the biggest and most powerful hard rock band, I think, that ever existed. There's some claim to truth there.
I guess what's most interesting about them when you say hard rock is the mix that they always had in their music of folk and blues influence, you know, mixed in with hard rock.
Indeed. So, I mean, you're absolutely right, and I would have gone on to say that. They were such an eclectic proposition, Zeppelin. So to tag them as any one thing, I think, is unfair to them and misleading. And I personally love their, you know, their unplugged acoustic music as much as I like their kind of proto-heavy metal, you know, headbangers. And I think they did that stuff just as well. And they did a lot of other things just as well. They covered so many bases and put their own unique imprint on all of them.
And they were eclectic not only in the mix of songs on any album, but even within a single song, they might veer from folk to rock.
Absolutely. You know, they were fearless, and the fearlessness was based on their just sheer accomplishments as musicians and their wide-ranging tastes and willingness to, as you say, within a single song, go off on all sorts of tangents. I think, you know, the idea that people have of Zeppelin in the sort of popular consciousness or mythology is very sort of narrow and kind of limited, and you think of Led Zeppelin in this rather sort of monolithic way, and it does them a disservice. They were capable of so much, and the music is so rich and so diverse, and yet it, in so many ways, it's been sort of reduced to this rather cliched idea of Zeppelin and their pomp, and I suppose, you know, things like Whole Lotta Love and in a different way, like Stairway to Heaven, a song like that, just that's how people think of them. And they could turn their hands to just about anything they wanted to do, and it all sounds completely unique, and it doesn't sound like anybody else.
It's a pretty amazing run they had for 10 or 12 years, I guess.
I think so.
Yeah. And I want to talk more about your book in a second, but let's just talk about the current state of Led Zeppelin. I was just mentioning to you off the air that they were on David Letterman the other night, and they just got the Kennedy Center Award, and they've just released, although it was recorded a couple of years ago, their reunion concert Blu-ray album package, Celebration Day. So is that the end of Led Zeppelin? Is it over now?
It seems to be a sort of halfway house in a way, while, you know, Robert kind of makes up his mind whether he ever really wants to take the show out on the road again, which, I suspect every day he sort of veers from, you know, from one idea of what he wants to do to the other, really. I think he sort of pretty much doesn't want to do it, because... I think for a number of reasons, but not least of which, you know, Zeppelin's music was a young man's music, and for him in his 60s to go out there and puff his chest out and attempt to hit high notes on songs like Immigrant Song, I just don't think he's physically capable of doing that, and probably feels like it's a bit of a sort of travesty. And the whole just overblown circus of it, I don't think appeals to him. So this is a kind of compromise, I suppose, for him. He's happy to put his shoulder to the wheel to promote this thing. He's, as you say, happy to go on Letterman with Page and Jones and do his bit. And you know, he certainly doesn't need the money. None of them need the money. And he is creatively fulfilled, I think, in his own work, in a way that certainly Jimmy isn't. I think so. Jimmy, out of all of them, is the one who'd most like to see Zeppelin properly reformed and back on the road. And it's been a constant frustration for him for many years that Robert won't give him what he wants.
Yeah, you kind of get the feeling that he's just kind of sitting around waiting for it to happen, and that's kind of odd because... In your book, the World's Greatest Rock Band, you really give us a picture of how the band developed, and really Jimmy Page was so much the force behind it creatively in the beginning.
Yes.
You'd think that after the band was over that he would just move on and do some other incredibly creative thing, but that really never happened for him.
No, and I think it's an interesting point, really, because... much as Jimmy would like to take most of the credit for what made Zeppelin great, and perhaps he's right to, if it had really just been about his own talent as a guitarist, as a producer, as a leader, then, as you say, I think he surely would have gone on to do a lot more interesting things than he's managed to do in the 32 years since Zeppelin came to a close. Whereas, you know, Robert, although there's been a lot of kind of hits and misses along the way, I mean, he has proved himself to a degree as a solo artist. He has managed to leave the legend of Led Zeppelin behind him in a way that Jimmy really hasn't. I think Jimmy's kind of stuck in Led Zeppelin, and that must be difficult for him. But he's never found, you know, he was lucky or canny enough to put together that extraordinary band, to find and recruit those three musicians, or the two musicians and Robert the singer. And he's never been able to recreate that, never been able to find accomplices like them again. And, well, you couldn't, I suppose. You couldn't ever find a drummer like John Bonham or a singer like Robert Plant again. But he's, you know, he's made some... I would say, I think a lot of people would say, some poor choices in terms of collaborators, and it sort of left him just looking very lost and left behind.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf, the World's Greatest Radio Show, and my guest is rock historian Barney Hoskins, just written a new book about Led Zeppelin. And with this book, Led Zeppelin, the Oral History of the World's Greatest Rock Band, You didn't so much write it as assemble many pieces from interviews you conducted with everyone connected with the band in almost any way from every phase of their history to create a chronicle of the band.
Yeah, I didn't set out with that approach in mind, but the more interviews I did, the more I began to see that I could construct a narrative out of the quotes I was getting, because I was just getting such great stuff from people, and I thought, well, you know, there are 3 or 4 big Zeppelin books out there, from Hammer of the Gods through to Mick Wall's book, and does the Zeppelin community really need another Zeppelin doorstopper? Even though I think there's an argument that, you know, we could still do with a less sensationalist approach to the band. Imagine like kind of Peter Guralnik treatment of Led Zeppelin. That doesn't sound improbable. And that's sort of what I had in mind. But as I say, I think I ended up doing about 130, 140 interviews for the book, and with many people who'd never spoken before, and I just thought, well, I like the oral history form. Yes, you don't get your own voice and your own real take in there, but I think it works as a form. It's very readable, and it's just a different way of telling the story. There were some gaps I had to plug. I tried to get material on every conceivable sort of aspect and stage of Zeppelin's career, but there were little gaps here and there where I got permission from other writers to use quotes from earlier interviews that they had done, and indeed the interviews that I myself had done with Plant Jones and Page back in about 2003. I did some fairly extensive interviews with them, which I was able to draw on. But I mean, you know, people seem to have responded well to it, even people who don't desperately like Led Zeppelin. I think it is such an extraordinary story, and it was just great to get insights from, people who are really on the inside, who had just never really... had their say before.
Well, I particularly love the early part of the story where, I mean, you really tell us the prehistoric history of Led Zeppelin dealing. It's almost the, I guess you kind of join it pre-Yardbirds or mid-Yardbirds, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I did a fair amount of research for the early years because that's the period that is least known about Zeppelin. In terms of the session work that Page and Jones did in London and the whole Midlands beat scene, the bands that Plant and Bonham came out of and played in together. I found that really interesting, and I made a few trips to the Midlands, the area around Birmingham, known as the Black Country, and talking to people who'd known Robert and Bonzo when they were really young. I mean, that was really interesting to me. I really wanted to give a sense of what Zeppelin came out of. I think too many sort of biographies of acts like Zeppelin try to present the artists as godlike talents that somehow are sui generis or invent their own genius, and of course it's never like that. Nothing comes out of nothing. So Zeppelin was a sort of manifestation of various strands of styles and genres and influences that just all sort of, you know, coalesced at the right moment, I think. And I wanted to give a sense of the various sort of cultural tributaries that sort of flowed into making Zeppelin what it was.
Well, Barney Hoskins, you mentioned earlier that Jimmy Page found these three amazing musicians, and he must have gone through a process of looking at a lot of people. Who are some of the other vocalists besides Robert Plant that he was thinking about?
Well, before he even knew of plants' existence, he was looking at people like Steve Marriott, possibly even Steve Winwood. He wanted to put together, a sort of super group. But the guy who came closest, I think, to filling the slot was Terry Reid, who was a great singer in that kind of blue-eyed soul, British blue-eyed soul sort of style. He didn't have as big a voice as Robert, but it was a very soulful voice. Would it have worked in Zappa? Not sure. Terry couldn't do it in any case because he'd just been signed to a solo deal by Mickey Most, who'd been the partner of Zeppelin's manager, Peter Grant. And Terry was about to go on the road as a support act of the Rolling Stones in America, and just said to Jimmy that he couldn't do it. But he recommended Robert and Bonzo because he toured with them on the... When Robert and Bonzo played in a group called the Band of Joy before Zeppelin, Terry had been on the road with them or shared bills with them and been incredibly impressed by them. So he urged Peter Grant and Jimmy to go and check Robert out, and that led eventually to Bonzo also joining the band.
Did they consider Rod Stewart at some point?
They didn't consider Rod Stewart, I don't think, really for Zeppelin. I'm sure Jimmy would have rated Rod Stewart as a singer. Who couldn't have? He was certainly, you know, if not the best, one of the very best in that kind of vein. But I think he might have been influenced by the fact that Rod had fallen out with Jeff Beck in the Jeff Beck group, and it might have been that Jeff had advised Jimmy not to hire Rod Stewart. I mean, Rod Stewart was already on course with his own career, and I'm sure that wouldn't really have worked either. Rod was a different kind of singer to Plant. I mean, Plant brought with him something that was, I think, probably more sort of romantic and mythical, and something that would have appealed more to Jimmy's idea of magic.
Yes, they had that thing going, right?
Yes. I don't think Rod Stewart would have been, you know, Rod Stewart wasn't reading Tolkien, and it just wouldn't have, you know, he wouldn't have responded in the same way as Robert did to Jimmy's, you know, very eclectic musical tastes, which sort of range from very powerful rock and roll to, you know, very delicate acoustic ballad.
And Robert Plant really loved California music, one of your passions.
Yes, you know, Plant was very smitten with the idea of California, both Northern and Southern California. And, you know, way before Zeppelin, he was entranced by what he was hearing. It was coming out of San Francisco and L.A. He loved, you know, Big Brother and the Holding Company, Jefferson Airplane. He loved Love, and he loved Buffalo Springfield. And he was very switched on to all of that. And as a sort of, as a kind of black country hippie, his dream, his fantasy was somehow to get out to California. That's where he wanted to be. And, you know, I mean, they absolutely worshipped Joni Mitchell, you know, which... you know, as a surprise, I would imagine to some people, you necessarily associate Zeppelin with Joni Mitchell, even if you know the song Going to California, which is sort of a tribute to Joni. But she was appreciative of that. I mean, she's gone on record as saying that it meant a lot to her that Led Zeppelin, of all bands, really championed her and really, really spoke up for her.
And I guess their teaming, Led Zeppelin's teaming with Sandy Denny must be connected to that somehow.
Yeah, I think there is a sort of connection there when you consider that Fairport Convention covered a number of Joni's early songs, like Chelsea Morning and so forth. Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the endearing things about Zeppelin is, you know, that a lot of hard rock bands are if not kind of misogynistic, at least sort of sexist and very male and testosterone driven. I really like the fact that Zeppelin weren't exclusively like that. That they they really adored and respected somebody like Sandy Denny, she is, as you know, is the only other artist to appear on a the only other singer to appear on a Led Zeppelin record. She was just a fantastic singer. Jimmy had known her on the kind of folk scene in the mid '60s, way before Zeppelin, and Robert absolutely worshipped her as a singer. I think it's just such a great thing that Sandy Denny is on a Led Zeppelin album.
Me too. I love that song. We're talking with Barney Hoskins. His new book is called Led Zeppelin: The Oral History of the World's Greatest Rock Band. And it would be a good time to mention your website, Rock's Back Pages. And you could actually hear you talking with Robert Plant at that site.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, there's also an enhanced ebook version of this Zeppelin book with the audio interviews included. At least, I'm not sure whether you can purchase that in the States, but you can hear. Faber, my English publishers, have done a version with the audio included. You can hear some of the quotes in the book in those audio interviews. I particularly enjoyed interviewing Robert. Jonesy to a slightly lesser degree and Page to a degree even lesser than that, I would say. But Plant is a great interview. You'll know that probably just from even seeing him on kind of Letterman. He's a very eloquent and amusing man, a great storyteller, a great... He enjoys language, so he talks very well, and one could talk to him about music probably all night and all day and never exhaust the subject. He's a passionate fan, and that's always, I think, very endearing in somebody who's had the kind of success he has had. He's never lost his fascination with the music of other people, which I'm not sure one could say the same of Jimmy Page.
So Robert Plant is still a fan of other people's music?
He's still absolutely, absolutely... fascinated by, but he's still a great collector. He's still he's still a fan. I think that's really important. It's really important you don't lose touch with that kind of inner fan, however much of a rock god you become. You need to hold on to that curiosity and that kind of appetite that you had when you were 16 years old. Otherwise, I think you become sort of jaded and too sort of self-involved.
Well, I guess the same thing could be said for you. I mean, it's one of the nice things about Rock's Back Pages is that it collects not just your own journalism, but hundreds and hundreds of great rock journalists that have written about our favorite music from the last 45 years or so.
Yes. Yes, well, that was certainly the vision, was to just try and gather together the work of as many great writers as possible. And I don't know how many we've got on there now, but it's well over 500 writers across all eras and genres, all ages and all races, genders. So, it's certainly a very useful resource for me, apart from for anybody else. Slowly but surely, we've achieved what we set out to do, and we just keep kind of adding to it, patiently. And. And it's it's like at least 10 years old now, and I'm still involved on a kind of yeah, it's my kind of day job, really, is what it was, is being the editorial director of Rock's Back Pages. Zeppelin started with the rock critics. There was this, you know, really, in hindsight, bizarre backlash against them, or just suspicion of Zeppelin. And so even though they became the biggest band in the world, there was still this sort of resentful suspicion of them, as if they were sort of somehow crass. And they were never crass.
This is a great book, and Barney Hoskins is the author. The book is called Led Zeppelin, The Oral History of the World's Greatest Rock Band, or it's also called Led Zeppelin Trampled Underfoot.
It's called Trampled Underfoot, The Power and Excess of Led Zeppelin here in the UK, which is a title I was rather fond of, but there we go. we can't have what we want as authors very often.
Barney Hoskins, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf, and I hope you come back and talk again soon.
Thanks so much, Gary. Nice speaking with you.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at www.fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can check us out on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Barney Hoskins, his latest book, Led Zeppelin, The Oral History of the World's Greatest Rock Band. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks, everybody.